fine welcome, she decided. I am pleased.
Winthrow once more swept his elegant bow and, with a sideways glance at me, walked a backward retreat. Tintagley's attention returned to me, and a sensation like a heavy blanket dropped over me. I kept my walls tight against her glamour as she advanced along the avenue the guard had opened in the crowd. Walking alongside her was challenging. Her pace was neither a human stroll nor a dash. It had been long since I'd been forced to trot so hastily. I glanced back to see Lant and Purr following at a safe distance. Spark was guiding Amber toward the portico.
You,
Tintaglia rumbled, almost quietly. Her tail lashed the ground as she walked, like a lazy cat's tail.
Presumptuously, you asked me for information in Kelsingra. However, I have cornered Icefire and wrung from him with shame and threats much that he should have shared with us years ago. Even Hebe has more courage than he. Your surmise was correct. Whites and their servants have done great injury to dragonkind. I burn with fury to think that generations of them believed they could wrong us without consequences. That shame is due entirely to Icefire's cowardice. But I have no belief that he will act. So I will.
We had reached the warehouse district, an older quarter of Divitown, where the streets were narrower. I walked uncomfortably close to Tintaglia, and several times heard crashes as her lashing tail encountered the fronts of the buildings. If there had been people here, the scurrying guards had cleared them away.
Understand, Farseer, this vengeance belongs to me. No mere human can deliver the punishment that Clarys deserves. When we come upon it, we will tumble it stone from stone and devour those who have dared to kill dragons, just as we did at Jailset. The satisfaction of those kills belongs to me.
Not if I get there first, I muttered. Abruptly, Tintaglia halted. For an instant, I regretted my ill-considered words, but then she lifted her head, snuffing the air. I smelled it too, the cattle pen, where animals were held during the loading or unloading of a ship. We were close. Emotions battled in me. I wanted my own vengeance, and if the fool was correct and my daughter lived, I did not want her caught up in a dragon's furious attacks on Clarys. Could I dissuade Tintaglia? Was there any chance that Paragon would be swifter than a vengeful dragon? My doubts that B lived were swept away in fear that I might never know. You will take revenge on the servants?
Did not I just tell you that? Humans, everything must be repeated.
She spoke with total disdain.
Listen now, before I go to feed. I tell you this in little pieces for your little mind. Yes, I allow you to go to Clarys. As you rudely asserted, if you arrive before me, you have permission to slaughter as you please. I will not count that as your stealing my kills. Do you understand this favor I grant you?
Yes. Yes, I do. But we now think it's possible that my daughter is still alive, that she might be a prisoner in Clarys. I might have been one of the flies buzzing on the manure pile for all the heed she gave me. The cattle pen was before us. The lowing, milling cows had caught her scent. They crowded hard against the walls of the corral. She trumpeted, a fierce, hungry sound that conveyed no words to my mind, and charged forward. Luck, not dexterity, saved me from a blow from her whipping tail. Then she was upon the poor trapped beasts, trampling them under her great claws and savaging them with her teeth. She seized one in her jaws and flung the bawling animal aloft. Lant snatched at my sleeve and dragged me back as the cow's broken body landed in the street close to where I had been. Purr's face was a mask of horror and fascination. The guards who had run ahead to clear her way jeered and roared in the way that some men do when faced with carnage. They were closer than I would have chosen to be, caught up in the barbarity of the moment. "We should leave her to feed," I told Lant and Purr. We turned and started back the way we had come. More than one building had suffered damage from Tintaglia's lashing tail. We walked around a splintered loading dock. I moved more slowly than I had, still trying to catch my breath.
"Sir, will you tell me what the dragon has been saying?"
Purr demanded. My throat was parched dry from my hasty jog to the cattle pen. I kept it short. "She says we have her permission to go to Clary's and kill people there. She also plans her own vengeance on Clary's when she gets there." Purr was nodding in a way that said he didn't comprehend it at all.
"Vengeance for what? Why?"
he asked. She didn't share the details. Evidently the Clary's folk once harmed some dragons. She is insulted that Icefire never punished them for it. She warned me that all of them are her rightful kills, but that she will permit us our own vengeance, if we get there first.
"Perhaps the black dragon thought that caving in half of Aslivyal was enough vengeance,"
Lance suggested. I shook my head. "Tintaglia doesn't agree."
"But sir!"
Perseverance caught at my arm.
"What if the dragon arrives before us? Amber says that Bee's there. She could be hurt or killed. Dragons do not seem to see much difference between us. Did you warn her that Bee was there? Did you tell her she must be careful?"
I mentioned that to her. Lance shied to one side as Motley swooped down to land on Purr's shoulder.
"Hebe," the bird announced. "Sparkling Hebe. Come, come, come. Hurry."
As quickly as she had perched, she lifted from Purr's shoulder and flew back toward the manor house. "I'd forgotten Hebe was coming," I admitted. Purr muttered.
"Only you could forget about a dragon."
In a louder voice, he added,
"Can we hurry?"
My pride forced me to do just that. A crowd had reformed around the green before the royal mansion. Purr pushed through, boldly shouting,
"Make a path for Prince Fitzchivalry! Make a path!"
I was too breathless to object. The pristine green was now as rumpled as a ploughed field. In the middle of the churned earth, Hebe stood. She wore a glorious harness of gleaming red leather and shining brass, topped with a sort of box, a perch for a rider. Hunger and weariness radiated from her, like heat from a stove. She was making a sound in her throat as she breathed, as if an immense kettle were about to come to a boil. In the portico of the manor, Queen Etta, Kennetson and Wintrow stood, with Amber and Spark to one side at a respectful distance. A rank of fresh guards, staves at the ready, stood between the queen and her uninvited guest. On a lower step, but so tall he was not looking up at them, clad all in scarlet leather and armor, was an elderling.
"Rapskull is here!"
Purr exclaimed in a mixture of surprise and dread. The elderling was gesticulating grandly, and as we circled well away from Hebe and approached the manor, I caught his words.
"And the night and the day, until we came here. We have travelled far, all the way from Kelsingrar in the Rain Wilds. My dragon and I bear important tidings for Fitzchivalry Farseer. If live meat could be found for her, I would be grateful. Please."
I had never heard General Rapskull so courteous, but it seemed that for Hebe he could humble himself and beg. Wintrow leaned closer to Queen Etta and said something softly. She did not look pleased, but issued her command.
"Bring her 3 goats. Let her have them here. The green is ruined anyway."
"And you are wise, Queen Etta, to let her feed at a safe distance from Tintaglia. I am grateful."
Rapskull looked over his shoulder at his impatient dragon, and his face softened with fondness.
"She is so hungry, and I have asked so much of her to carry me so far,
and we have farther yet to go, all the way to Others Island, and then Clares.
He saw me then, and turned away from Etta, exclaiming,
Fitzchivalry, there you are! I bring you important tidings.
I advanced hastily. Tintaglia has shared them with me already, General Rapscow. I am surprised to see you here.
As are we all,
Queen Etta announced icily,
especially since you have not yet shared with me the reason for this visit.
There was no mistaking her displeasure, but just as unnerving to me was how Kennetson was staring at Hebe. He suddenly stepped down, past the startled guard, and even past Rapscow, and walked directly toward her. My breath caught in my throat. The dragon was hungry, and he was a stranger. But she only twisted her head at him and regarded him with gently whirling eyes.
"Bring this wondrous dragon a tub of water," he commanded suddenly. "She is parched with thirst. No creature so glorious should suffer such privation. And where are the goats? Should not they be here by now? Bring her one of the brown bullocks as well. She is famished."
And the idiot approached the hungry dragon, his hand outstretched. A murmur of dismay and consternation rose from the gathered crowd. Etta's mouth hung slightly ajar in breathless fear.
"No!"
Wintrow cried, starting forward. I expected Rapscow to leap forward to save the prince, but although the elderling was in motion, he was coming across the green toward me. I noticed Sorkor moving swiftly and too late to shadow Kennetson's movement. Hebe would eat the prince. But Hebe only extended her head until her scaled snout touched Kennetson's hand. My breath eased out of me. I wondered if Kennetson's display had been true bravery, or if he had fallen prey to the dragon's glamour. He lifted his other hand and set it to her face.
"Lovely one," the prince said, and the dragon lowered her head to him to allow him to scratch her brow.
A sigh, a murmur of approval from the gathered throng, told me what I had not guessed before. The people of the Pirate Isles adored their prince. I might have seen him as a spoiled man-boy, but his flair of elegance and this show of bravado dazzled the crowd. As the goats came blatting around the corner of the manor house, Hebe lifted her head and looked over her shoulder at them.
"Go," the prince bade her. "Satisfy your hunger, you beauteous thing."
He stood fearlessly as she spun and leapt. For the second time that day, I watched a dragon make a kill and listened to a roar of approval from the crowd.
"Where?"
Lant muttered, stepping up beside me, and Purr quickly moved to my other flank as Rapscull approached, his hand extended to clasp wrists with me. A wide smile of white teeth looked peculiar in his scarlet-scaled face. I met his hand, but he did not release it after our clasp. Instead, he tugged at me as if I had forgotten my manners.
"Don't stand there, Fitzchivalry. I must present myself to their queen."
He lifted his voice to cry,
"Enjoy your meal, Hebe, my glorious one. Prince, thank you for such a kind greeting. Now that my dragon is well tended, I shall convey to Fitzchivalry all that he must know."
He took my arm and I led him. We advanced together across the dragon-torn turf, Lant and Purr close behind us. A bullock bellowed in alarm, and I turned to see the poor, panicked creature being dragged and chivied toward the dragon.
"Release it!"
Kennetson bellowed, and they did. The cattle boys barely evaded the dragon's charge as bullock and predator savaged another half-acre of garden. This bullock was a fighter, and his horns had not been removed. He made several attempts to gore Hebe. She sprang into the air and came down on him with all 4 feet, a cat pouncing on a mouse. His bellow ended in a terrible wet crunch. Purr made a sound of dismay, but the mob shouted with piratical amusement. Rapscow could not have planned a better entertainment for them than bull-baiting in the Queen's garden.
the prince lifted his arms wide overhead in triumph and shouted,
"Fear her not, my people! This scarlet beauty has come in friendship!"
The crowd's resounding approval was deafening. Queen Etta and her party had retreated slightly from the steps, but Wintrow had remained on the portico and was gesturing to us to join them. Rapscal and I reached the wide white steps and ascended them to where Queen Etta stood transfixed by her son's spectacle. I heard her whisper softly, "He has his father's gift for winning hearts. This is good." We climbed more steps to where a stiffly smiling Wintrow posed. Amber and Spark awaited us there, faces frozen in uncertainty.
"What is this about?"
he demanded in a low voice while greeting me in apparently affable fashion.
"What chaos have you brought to our doorstep, Fitzchivalry? A mad ship stealing our prince for your mission of vengeance, and now dragons on our green?"
Etta kept her eyes on her son.
"Stand down, Wintrow. We appear to be establishing diplomatic relations with the Rainwilds."
She gave Wintrow a sideways glance.
"I think the prince who befriends dragons may deserve a bride that comes with a larger dowry."
She lifted her hand from her sword hilt and turned her smile toward Rapscal. There was a lilt of amusement in her voice.
"Greetings! I am Queen Etta of the Pirate Isles. This is my chief minister and admiral, Wintrow Vestrit."
"Name's well known to me." Rapscal offered them a bow. "I am General Rapscal of the Dragon Traders of Kelsingrar. No diplomat, I fear, most gracious queen, but a loyal messenger for the dragons."
He still had a firm hold on my arm and patted it fondly.
"When Prince Fitzchivalry visited us, he wished to know if the history of the dragons intersected with that of the servants of the Pale Folk. We have obtained that information from Icefire, and it is of great importance that he know that his vengeance may align with ours, but does not supersede it."
He turned to me and added,
"I assure you that I can convey the information much more concisely than Tintaglia and without her impatience."
"How comforting," I replied, and to my surprise, that won a soft chuckle from Queen Etta.
"Doubtless you can then tell me, swiftly and clearly, what an invasion of dragons has to do with this man's mission to rescue his daughter."
"A coincidence of fate,"
Rapscal assured her.
"But I beg you, may I have food and drink before I begin my telling?"
Wintrow chose a smile.
"Please, enter. I'll be with you shortly. I must issue a few orders to the guards. Few of them are familiar with dragons, but I have had enough interactions with them to know that careless words or deeds can bring death." "Ask my son to attend me,"
Etta directed him.
"Oh, he will not wish to leave Hebe,"
Rapscal informed her familiarly and fondly.
"I saw the look on his face and sensed her approval of him. He will stay by her while she is feeding, and possibly while she sleeps as well."
Wintrow was nodding.
"Likely it will be as he says. They are enamored of each other. Tintaglia had much the same effect on my brother, Selden. She will be unlikely to harm him, and the citizens are taking great pleasure in watching their prince befriend a dragon."
The queen's expression did not change.
"Nonetheless, I will invite him,"
Wintrow assured her and left us. Rapscal hooked his arm firmly through mine, a gesture I thoroughly disliked. We followed Queen Etta. I did not like how her guard closed in around us, but I held my tongue. As it was with dragons, so it is with queens. A careless word or deed could have severe consequences. Inside the royal mansion, it was cooler and dimmer. Everywhere I looked, a history of pirate looting prevailed in tapestries and statuary, exotic draperies and foreign treasures.
There was a remarkable lack of formality as the Queen herself guided us to a sitting room.
"Find food and drink,"
she commanded one of her servants.
"Oh, I would be so grateful for that,"
Rapscal responded. He turned his attention back to me.
Hebe could not keep pace with Tintaglia, try as she might. We knew Tintaglia would not wait for us. Our errand is urgent, with little time to spare, even to give this message.
The Queen had taken her seat at the head of a very long table. There were more than enough chairs for all of us. I maneuvered Rapscal so that he sat at Etta's left hand and took a chair next to him, leaving a place for Amber beside me. Lant took the next place, and after some uncertainty, Spark and Purr took chairs. They exchanged a look, seated at a pirate queen's table. Queen Etta let her gaze rove over all of us.
"Welcome to my home,"
she said. The sarcasm in her greeting was wasted on the elderling.
"You are so gracious," Rapscal replied artlessly, "and far more beautiful than I expected. Oh, and here is the refreshment you sent for. I am so parched and so hungry."
As soon as the serving woman had filled his glass, he lifted it and drank deeply. For a moment, she stared at him. I waited for her to rebuke him for his ill manners. Instead, she suddenly leaned back on one arm of her chair. I saw the pirate who had become a queen as she said,
"And you are much more forthright and simple than I expected an envoy to be."
"Yes, I am that,"
he agreed happily as he held out his glass to be refilled.
"But scarcely an envoy. General I might be, and master of Kelsingrar's forces when I am there, but on this errand I serve my dragon, and indeed all dragonkind. I shall be sure that all dragons of Kelsingrar hear of your hospitality."
"How kind of you. Should I be glad of that, or terrified?"
She sent her gaze around the table, and then laughed aloud, apparently finding Rapscal more amusing than offensive. Wintrow entered and took a place at the Queen's right hand.
"And my son?"
she asked of him.
"He is passing the time with the Red Dragon, and has sent for 3 more cows."
Wintrow looked at me and added,
"Your crow has joined them."
"She enjoys the company of the Red Dragon," I offered. Questions and concerns boiled inside me, but this was the Queen's table.
"So, my son sails with you to rescue your daughter, and somehow this exposes him to the company of dragons?"
Queen Etta stared at me, but it was Rapscal who responded. He had cleared his plate of food and was watching alertly the servant approach with a platter of sliced meat.
"Let me make all clear for everyone. We have come to tell Fitzchivalry and Lady Amber that the dragons approve and allow their mission of vengeance. Indeed, once our errand is done, we shall follow them to Clarys to finish whatever destruction they have begun. We intend to level the city and raise the surrounding countryside."
He took a long draught of his wine, apparently unaware of Queen Etta's wide-eyed expression. He set his glass down with a heavy sigh.
"Fitzchivalry is not the only one who has been wronged by these servants. Far more grievous is our injury from them. In league with the abominations, they have ransacked the nesting beach, stealing dragon eggs and killing or imprisoning the hatchling serpents. Tomorrow we fly swiftly on to Others Island to protect the eggs buried there until the summer hatching season. Tintaglia shall stand guard over the nests and shepherd the hatchling serpents as they make their way to the sea, while Hebe and I hunt down and kill the abominations who infest that place."
"Abominations?"
Amber asked softly. She had kept silent and watchful until that moment.
"So we name them. They occur when a dragon
who has been too long among humans, lays her eggs, and they do not hatch into serpents, but something neither serpent nor human nor elderling. Grotesque and evil creatures. We will slaughter them. Ice fire alone knew how they had wronged us, how they dug the eggs from the nest mounds, or preyed upon the young serpents as they tried to make their way to the sea. Some they killed to devour or to sell their bodies to the servants of the whites. Or worse, imprisoned them for decades, harvesting the secretions of their bodies for potions and medicines.
His scaled lips curled in disgust.
The abominations consume those secretions. They claim it aids them to foretell the future and remember distant pasts.
Wintrow set down his glass with a sharp sound on the table.
Etta, he said in a low voice, we've been there, on the treasure beach. Those creatures, the serpent I freed.
I recall that, she said faintly.
Wintrow spoke to Rapscal. Kennet took me there to see what the others might predict for me. He had been there before, I believe, with Ygrot. There was a tradition that if you found something washed up on the treasure beach and surrendered it to the creatures that live there, they would foretell your future. But I found no treasure, only an immense serpent held captive in a caged pool. The higher tides would replenish the water around it, but the creature was stunted and twisted from living in such a small space. It spoke to me. I managed to free it. Though its passing touch took the skin from my flesh, and I nearly drowned for my efforts.
I recall that, Etta said.
Sorkor, too, spoke of a previous visit Kennet made there.
A faint smile touched her lips.
He destroyed what he found, rather than surrender it to the creature there.
That was Kennet,
Wintrow agreed, and I could not tell if there was fondness or dismay in his voice. For a moment, a strange silence held.
Heroic!
Rapscal exclaimed. His fist thudded the table, making us all jump, and his eyes shone with tears.
I will share this tale with Hebe and with all the dragons.
For a moment, he was silent and staring. Wintrow and Etta exchanged a look. Was I the only one who sensed a flow of communication between him and his dragon? Then, from the direction of the docks, I heard Tintaglia's trumpeting. Rapscal stood abruptly and suddenly stripped the rings from his fingers. He clacked the cluster of jewelry on the table and pushed them toward Wintrow. There were tears in his eyes.
A small gift of elderling jewelry, insufficient for the man who freed a serpent from the slavery of the abominations. The gratitude of dragons is a rare commodity. You have the gratitude of all elderlings as well.
He turned his gaze to Etta.
And Hebe tells me you send your son to accompany Fitzchivalry to aid in taking this vengeance. Hebe is pleased. She wraps him in her highest regard. She promises that when she reaches Clarys, we shall find him.
He lifted his voice to a shout.
He will ride upon her back to smite them.
Silence filled the room. Amber broke it.
Then the dragons go to Clarys with us to take their vengeance?
Was there hope or dread in her voice? Rapscal set down his glass and shook his head.
Not immediately. Our mission to protect the hatching eggs is the more pressing one. When the hatching season is complete and we are satisfied that every abomination has been slain, we will come there.
When last we spoke, we believed my daughter was dead. Now we believe she may have survived, that B may be a prisoner in Clarys. Amber broke in.
If she's in the city and the dragons attack, she may be injured or killed.
Rapscal nodded to that.
Killed is likelier, he conceded. The destruction we wrought on Chaelsed was very thorough. Buildings collapsed, the acid breath of the dragons sprayed over people and beasts.
He nodded his satisfaction.
I doubt that anyone within the Duke's palace survived.
Then, as he looked around at the horror on our faces, he said suddenly,
I see your concern, indeed.
And you can speak to Tintaglia and Hebe, ask them to aid us, or at least allow us to make our rescue attempt before they bring the city down?
Amber was breathless with hope. He steepled his long-fingered hands and looked down at their scarlet nails. We waited in silence. At last, he said quietly,
I will tell them, but...
He lifted his eyes and met my gaze squarely.
I can promise nothing. I think you already know that. Dragons are not... They do not regard humans...
His voice trailed away. They will not consider it important. My words fell like dead birds.
Exactly. I am sorry.
He toyed with his fork and added,
Your best hope is to be there before they are, to try to rescue her before they lay siege to the city. Truly, I am sorry.
I wondered if he was. I wondered if he were not very like a dragon himself, unable to grasp the importance of one child. Rapscal lifted his head as if he was listening to something.
Hebe is sated. You have provided well for her. I thank you.
Again his face took on that pensive look. Then he smiled.
I believe that Tintaglia is as well. Now they will sleep. Such a flight has wearied both of them, and Hebe is close to exhaustion.
He looked at me and quirked one scaled brow, as if to remind me that we shared a secret.
Luckily, I carry in her saddle a supply of a restorative. Tomorrow, she shall have it. But for the rest of the day and all tonight, she must sleep. And so must I.
He turned his smile on Wintrow and Etta.
Could you prepare a bedchamber for me and a bath? I confess I am wearied and aching in every limb. Traveling so high above the earth, it is always cold. I could sleep a bit in my saddle, but it was not true rest.
Queen Etta's eyes narrowed to be addressed as if she were a chamber servant. I anticipated Etta coming to her feet with her hand on a sword's hilt. But instead, Wintrow pushed hastily back from the table. He knew when his queen had reached her limit for tolerance.
If you will follow me, General Rapscal, I will be pleased to surrender my own chamber to your use. I'm sure that is the swiftest way to find you a place to rest. Gentlemen, ladies, if you will excuse us.
And they went, leaving Queen Etta and my party at the table. Abruptly, the queen stood up.
You need to leave as soon as possible, to have a chance to reach Clara's before the dragons, to save your child.
That is so. I fought to control my voice. I was still trying to accept the fatalism I had heard in Rapscal's words. The allies I had hoped for had now become a different sort of threat.
And you take my son into a greater danger than I perceived.
I consider that likely. She nodded slowly.
He is his father's son. This business with the dragons and their vengeance, it will only fire his determination steel hard.
She fixed me with a considering stare.
Well, Prince Fitzchivalry, you have brought more excitement, disaster, and puzzlement to Divytown than we have enjoyed in many a year.
I heard the clack of boots, and Kennetson strode into the room. There was a fire in his eyes I had not seen there before.
Mother, I have come to tell you that I am determined to sail tomorrow on the first tide.
The sooner we reach Clarez, the sooner we can take a vengeance long delayed.
His gaze swept us, and then he turned and departed. Etta stared after her son for a long moment.
So like his father. She turned to me. I had hoped to delay your departure. Now I will give commands that the ship be well provisioned by nightfall.
As she rose from the table, she added in a chilling voice,
Farseer, you have lost your child. Do not lose mine as well.
Chapter 21 Under Sail.
The first time the mountain burned was in the summer. Some said the earth's shaking broke the distant mountain. Others that the mountain woke, and that caused the earth to shake. It was not the first time that the earth had quaked under us. Always there had been tremors. Hence, we had always built with stone rich in the silver threads that could be magicked to stand firm and remember their purpose in the world. But in that shaking, although most of our building stood firm, a crack opened in the earth itself from the river to the district of the Tinkers. Later, it would fill with water from the river, and we would accept it as a part of our city. A rain fell on the city that was not only water, but contained black sand. It dusted the streets, and some of the folk and three of the dragons took a cough from it. Dark clouds gathered over Kelsingrar, and day was like night for 12 days. Birds fell lifeless to the ground, and fish washed up along the shores of the river. All the while, far in the distance, what had been the snowy peak of Sissifolk glowed like a cauldron of melted iron.
Memory Cube 941, found in a corridor in Aslivyal, transcribed by Shade Fullstar. At dawn the next day, the dragons departed. Etta had been as good as her word. We had worked through the night, taking on supplies and making all ready to catch the first tide. I do not think the dragons gave warning or farewell to anyone. They rose from the ground, and our crow circled below, cawing unhappily as they rose higher and higher into the sky in slow circles over Divitown before departing to the south and east. As I dropped my eyes, I saw that Vivacia was in full sail below them. Brashen strode past me on the deck, and I pointed her out to him. Word came late last night. Vivacia was determined to go to Others Island with the dragons to see what has transpired there, and afterward perhaps she will follow them to Clary's. I stared after them, wondering what that meant for my mission, until Brashen slapped me on the back.
"The ale casks will not store themselves," he pointed out,
and I moved to where Clef was putting hands onto a hoist. Not long after, the Prince of the Pirate Isles came alongside in a small boat. Sorkor was at the oars, pulling hard and well for a man of his years. Two ornate trunks and a canvas seaman's bag rowed in the center of the boat. Kennetson perched in the bow, with the plumes of his hat nodding in the wind. A youngster, finely attired, sat on one of the trunks. Clef spotted them and strode purposefully toward the captain's stateroom. A moment later, both Althea and Brashen appeared. Althea's mouth was taut and her eyes narrowed like an angry cat. Brashen looked relaxed and in command. Kennetson ascended the ladder first, followed by the youngster. Sorkor joined us on the deck. Two of Etta's sailors clambered over the side to bring the trunks aboard. As Kennetson looked around, Sorkor spoke.
"Well," he said heavily, "here we are."
"Peregrin Ludluck! To me, young man! To me!" cried the ship.
Without a word or a glance at Althea or Brashen, Kennetson walked toward the figurehead. Over his shoulder he called to the youngster.
"Bala, see to my things. Arrange my stateroom as I like it. Be lively about it."
Sorkor watched him go, and a blush reddened the old pirate's cheeks. Without looking at Brashen or Althea, he said quietly,
I'd like to come with you.
We've already enough captains on this vessel, Brashen replied, trying to soften his decision with humor. If you're aboard, not only Kennetson, but every sailor you've offered us will look to you before following an order from me or Althea.
That's true, Sorkor admitted.
We watched as the first heavy trunk of Kennetson's essentials was lifted and swung over Paragon's deck. Sorkor's eyes tracked the trunk's journey. He gave a small sigh. You want a free hand with the lad, don't you? Don't want me stepping in if I think you're too rough on our young prince.
I do, Brashen admitted. I can't think of him as a lad, let alone as a prince. The ship wants him aboard. You'd like him to learn something of our trade.
He gave a deprecating laugh.
And I'd like a bit of peace aboard this vessel. That's only going to happen if I treat him like any other hand. So I told him last night, when his mother was chaining that charm snug to his throat. I don't think he heard a word we said to him, but I give him over to you.
A small silence followed Sorkor's capitulation. The old pirate turned to Bala, who was guiding the heavy trunk down to the deck, and said quietly,
Lass, tell them to take that one back. The canvas sea bag is all we need brought aboard.
Then he squared his shoulders.
Kennetson and Trelvestrick got along well whenever Vivasea was in port. Wintrow threw them together whenever he could. He wanted your boy to get a feel for our politics and to pick up a bit of polish. Begging your pardon, Wintrow's words, not mine.
Brashen gave a wry twist of his mouth.
Polish, eh? I'd have said Boyo had the trader's polish already, but no offence taken. I'd appreciate it if your lad stood by him now. He could teach him your ways. The same way Trelvestrit learned our ways from Kennetson. He'll have to learn this deck and everything above and below it. I know Kennetson's in for some rough seas before he fits in here. He's never lived aboard a ship. Never been...
He shook his big head.
My fault,
he said hoarsely.
I'll teach him,
Brashen said in a low voice.
He'll have to bend a bit, but I won't deliberately break him. The first thing he'll have to learn is how to take an order.
He cleared his throat and gave Sorkor an apologetic look.
Grit your teeth and stand back, Sorkor.
Then Brashen drew breath and bellowed,
Kennetson, your gear is aboard. Come and stow it. Boyo, show him his hammock and help him square himself away.
Boyo came at a run, a grin on his face, which faded when he saw the trunk being lowered back over the side. Bala shrugged and went down the ladder after it. A moment later, one of the new hands appeared, the canvas sea bag slung over her shoulder. She set it down on the deck as Kennetson strode up. He had not loitered, but neither had he hastened. He looked at Brashen with his eyebrows cocked.
My hammock?
He queried, a small smile on his lips as if he was certain the captain had misspoken.
Right by mine,
Boyo interjected.
Grab your sea bag and let's take it below.
I wondered if Kennetson heard the note of warning in his friend's voice.
Below?
Kennetson asked, his eyebrows venturing toward his hairline. His glance flickered to Sorkor and waited for him to intervene. Brashen slowly crossed his arms on his chest. There was reluctance on Sorkor's face, but no challenge, as the old pirate offered.
Good voyaging, Captain Trell. May you have smooth seas and a steady wind. I doubt I'll get either at this time of year, heading southeast, but I appreciate the wish. Please convey my respects to Queen Etta. I would thank her again for all she has done to equip us for this voyage and to help us make amends with our trading partners. I'll be sure she knows you thank her.
I could see Sorkor's unwillingness to leave. Behind him, incredulous indignation was building on Kennetson's face. Boyo had picked up the sea bag.
Where are my trunks?
Kennetson demanded.
Where is my valet?
That's your sea bag there, in Trelvestrit's hands. I packed it myself. Everything you need is in there.
Sorkor turned slowly and made his way to the side of the ship. Below, the dory that had ferried them out awaited him. Bala popped her head up over the railing. Sorkor shook his head and motioned her to return to the dory. Puzzled, she obeyed. Sorkor straddled the railing beside the rope ladder.
Honor your father's memory. Become a man.
Kennetson stared after him, his cheeks going scarlet.
I am a man, he bellowed after Sorkor.
Brashen spoke in an even voice.
Boyo, drop it.
As soon as his son obeyed, he turned to the pirate prince.
Can you manage your own sea bag, sailor? I can tell Prince Fitzchivalry to give you a hand with it, if there's need.
His voice betrayed no emotion. He was a captain finding the limits of a new hire. I had watched the scene unfold as if I watched a puppet play, leaning on the ship's railing a short distance away. At Trell's suggestion, I straightened and stepped forward briskly to help with the sea bag. I was a bit puzzled at his request. The canvas bag was not so large that it presented any sort of a challenge, but I had given my word that I'd help sail the ship, and I intended to live up to that at least.
Out of my way, I can manage it,
Kennetson declared. Captain Trell gave a small jerk of his head, and I moved away. Kennetson had strength more than equal to moving his sea bag, but he deployed it in the sullen overreaction of a spoiled boy. I reminded myself that he was not my problem, and took myself to Amber's cabin. There I found the fool, sitting cross-legged on the lower bunk, with one of B's books open in his lap. I wondered if you had changed your mind and gone to Divitown with the others.
Sight-seeing?
He asked and gestured at his ruined eyes. I sat down beside him, bowing my head to avoid hitting it on the bunk above. I hoped you were regaining a bit of your vision. You're looking at a book.
I'm touching a book, Fitz.
He sighed and held it out to me. I felt a jolt of dismay. It was her journal, not her book of dreams. Open to a page I hadn't shared with him. Did he know? I closed it gently, found the shirt I always used, and rewrapped it carefully. I slid it back into my worn pack. I feared he might accidentally discover the silver, but I said only, "We must be very careful with my pack. The firebrick from Rain is in here. It must always be stored upright." As I placed it carefully under the bunk, I told him, "Kennetson has come aboard. We'll be leaving on the change of the tide."
Have Lant, Purr, and Spark returned yet?
They won't be late. Lant had some bird messages to send. Purr wanted help to get word to his mother. Spark wished to send a message to Shade.
So today, we finally resume our journey.
The breath he expelled was uneven.
Yet there is still so far to go, and every moment that passes is a moment that she is too long in their possession. Any moment may be the moment she dies.
Panic rose in me. I pushed it down and denied it. Hardened my heart and extinguished hope. I tried to share my defense. Fool, despite what you believe, despite what you have dreamed, if I imagine this is a rescue, not an assassination, I will lose my focus, and it is all I have left. Alarm claimed his face.
But she is alive, Fitz. My dreams make me certain of it. I wish I could share them with you.
So you've had more than one dream of B still alive? I asked reluctantly. Could I bear to hear any more of his wishful proof?
I have,
he replied, and then, tilting his head,
though perhaps only I could interpret them that way. It is not so much the images as the feel of the dream that makes me certain they pertain to B.
He paused and grew thoughtful.
Possibly I could share my dreams with you, if you touched me with no thought of healing, but only of sharing, perhaps.
No. I tried to soften my refusal. When we link, fool, what happens has nothing to do with my intent. Something that feels inevitable begins to happen, like the current of a river sweeping us along.
Like the Skill River you speak of, like a current of magic?
No, it's different.
Then what is it?
I sighed. How can I explain something that I don't understand myself?
Oomph. When I say something like that, you get angry at me.
I brought us back to the subject. You said you've had more dreams about B.
I have.
A short response and a secret unspoken. I pressed him. What sort of dreams, fool? Where do you dream her? What is she doing?
You know my dreams are not like windows into her life. They are hints and portents, such as the dream about the candles.
He tilted his head.
You recall how B wrote of it? I'll tell you something. That's an old dream, dreamed often and by many. It could mean so many things, yet I think it is fulfilled in us. B dreams it more clearly than I've ever heard it, speaking of us as the wolf and the jester.
How could many people dream the same dream? I pushed aside his confusing words. Without intending it, my voice had dropped to the level of a wolf's warning growl. His sightless eyes widened slightly.
We just do. It's one measure the servants use to consider the likelihood of something happening. It's a common dream among those who carry white bloodlines. Each one is slightly different, but they are recognizable as the same dream. I dreamed it as a fork in a path. There are four candles spaced along the path in one direction. At the end of it, there is a little stone house with a low door and no windows, the place where the dead are put. The other path is lit by three candles. At the end of it, a fire burns and people are shouting.
He took a small breath.
I stand, staring at it. Then, out of the dark, a bee comes and buzzes in circles around my head.
And that makes you think that the dream is about my bee. He nodded slowly.
But not just because of a bee in the dream. It was the feeling of the dream. And it wasn't the only one I had.
What do the dreams mean? I asked the question, despite suspecting that his recent dreams meant no more than the dreams I had. When I had brought him back from the dead, he had told me he was blind to the new future we had made. Did his mind now play tricks on him, sending him dreams of what he desperately hoped to be true?
I could say, you don't want to know, but I would be lying. The truth is, I don't want to tell you. But I know I must,
he added hastily before I could speak. He cleared his throat and looked down at his hands. He rubbed them together as if remembering pain. He had a few fingernails now on his bared hand, and the others seemed to be growing. I looked away from the reminder of what he had endured. The body might heal, but the wounds that dedicated torture leave on the mind always seep toxic pus. I reached across and took his gloved hand in mine. Tell me.
She isn't treated well.
I had expected that. If she was still alive, her captors were unlikely to be gentle with her. But to hear that spoken aloud was like the fist to the belly that drives all breath away. How? I managed. Dreams, I reminded myself. Probably not. Real.
I don't know.
His voice was a hoarse whisper.
I dreamed of a wolf cub licking her wounds and curling tight against the cold. I dreamed of a slender white tree stripped of its blossoms and its tender branches bent awry.
I could not breathe. He made a small sound of pain, and I realized I was crushing his fingers. I loosened my grip and found air.
But I also dreamed of a hand holding a dead torch. It was a confusing dream. The torch fell to the ground, and a foot ground it out. I heard a voice.
better to grope in darkness than to follow false light.
He paused and added,
"The confusing part was that it was already dark. An immense blaze of light came up as the torch was ground out."
"How do you know that dream was about B?" He looked abashed.
"I am not certain, but it might be. And it felt uplifting, like something that might be good. I wanted to share it with you."
There was a hasty knock, and an instant later, Spark flung open the door.
"Oh!"
she exclaimed upon seeing our clasped hands. I released the fool. She recovered herself to announce,
"Captain Trell wants every able-bodied person on the deck. Time to weigh anchor and depart. Clef sent me to find you. He nabbed Purr and Lant as soon as we came back on board."
I was relieved to leave off our discussion of dark dreams, but the fool's words haunted me all that day. I was grateful for the times when the distraction of learning the ropes and how the ship moved blocked my anxiety for my daughter. No matter how I moved my thoughts, I was cut. B was dead, tattered away in the skill stream. B was alive and living in torment. I worked my body as hard as I could, seeking exhaustion, then took a hammock below decks with the crew where their talk and cursing and laughter kept dreams away. We were a day out from Divvy Town when a downcast Purr came to me.
"Have you seen Motley?"
I had not noticed the crow's absence until he spoke of it. "I haven't," I admitted. Unwillingly, I added, "Crows are shore birds, Purr. There was plenty of feed for her in Divvy Town. That's not true out on the open water. I know that you shared your rations with her when we were running short, but perhaps she prefers to fend for herself now."
"I just reblacked her feathers. What will become of her when the black wears off?"
"I don't know," I admitted reluctantly. "She was a wild thing at heart, and always would be. She'd made it clear she did not want a wit bond. I tried to let go of her." Nonetheless, relief flooded me on the second day when we heard a distant cawing. Purr and I were up the rigging that day, leaning on the spar, our feet braced on the footlines. At first, she was a tiny silhouette in the distance, but as we watched, her steadily beating wings brought her closer and closer. She called a greeting and then landed solidly on Purr's arm.
"Tired," she said. "So tired."
She walked up his shoulder to nestle under his chin. "I swear, sometimes I am certain she knows every word we say," I observed.
"Every word,"
she repeated, and regarded me with one bright eye. I stared at her. The tip of her beak was silver. "Purr," I warned him, trying to keep my voice calm. "Keep her away from your face. She has silver on her beak." I saw the boy freeze. Then he said in a shaky voice,
"I can't sense magic at all. Maybe I'm immune to silver, too."
"And maybe you're not. Please, move her away from your throat." He lifted his wrist, and the bird transferred herself to his hand.
"What did you do?"
he asked her.
"How did you get silver on your beak, pretty thing? Are you all right? Do you feel ill?"
In response, she turned and groomed her flight feathers. They did not go silver, but they sheened blacker than I'd ever seen them.
"Hebe," she croaked. "Hebe, share. Hebe, teach how."
Ah, Rapscal's tonic back at Divvy Town. I should have guessed. And was her time with the dragons improving her speech? "Be careful with your beak," I chided her. She turned her shining eyes on me.
"I am careful, stupid Fitz, but so tired. Take me to Paragon."
She clambered up Purr's sleeve to his shoulder again and gave me a baleful look before closing her eyes. I heard Trell roaring at us to get a move on and stop perching like seagulls. Purr looked to me, ignoring his captain.
"Do I take her to Paragon?"
"I doubt you can keep her away, and no matter how careful she is, I want you to be even more careful. warn any others that she might fly to. Brashen roared again, and Purr began his hasty descent, shouting that Motley had returned. As Purr spidered and slid with the bird on his shoulder, Spark crossed the